At dawn the following day, the royal flotilla sailed south from Karnak. As the king had promised, my lady Lostris and all her entourage were on board one of the small fast galleys of the southern squadron. I sat with my mistress on the cushions under the awning on the poop that the captain had arranged especially for her. We looked back at the lime-washed buildings of the city shining in the first tangerine tints of the rising sun. "I cannot think where he has gone," she was fretting over Tanos, as she had a score of times since we had set sail. "Did you look everywhere for him?" "Everywhere," I confirmed. "I spent half the morning scouring the inner city and the docks. He has disappeared, but I left your message with Kratos. You can be sure Kratos will deliver it to him."
5 years without him. Will they ever pass?
The voyage upriver passed pleasantly enough in long, leisurely days spent sitting on the poop deck in conversation with my mistress. We discussed every detail of our changed circumstances in great depth and examined all that we might expect and hope for in the future. I explained to her all the complexities of life at the court, the president and the protocol. I traced for her the hidden lines of power and influence, and I listed all those whom it would be in our interest to cultivate and those whom we could safely ignore. I explained to her the issues of the day and how Pharaoh stood on each of them. Then I went on to discuss with her the feeling and the mood of the citizenry. In a large measure, I was indebted to my friend Aten, the royal chamberlain, for all this intelligence. It seemed that over the last dozen years, every ship that had come downriver from Elephantine Island to Karnak had carried a letter from him to me, full of these fascinating details, and on its return to Elephantine Island had carried a golden token of my gratitude back to my friend Aten. I was determined that we would soon be at the centre of the court and in the mainstream of power. I had not trained my mistress all these years to see the weapons that I had placed in her armoury rust with disuse. The sum of her many accomplishments and her talents was already formidable, but I was patiently adding to it each day. She had a keen and restless mind. Once I had helped her to throw off the black mood that had threatened to destroy her, she was, as always, open to my instruction. Every chance I had, I fired up her ambition and her eagerness to take up the role I had planned for her. I soon found that one of the most effective means of enlisting her attention and cooperation was to suggest that all this would be to the eventual benefit and advantage of Tanos. "If you have influence at court, you will be better able to protect him," I pointed out to her. "The king has set him an almost impossible task to fulfil. Tanos will need us, if he is to succeed, and if he fails, only you will be able to save him from the sentence that the king has placed upon him."
"What can we do to help him carry out his task?"
At the mention of Tanos, I immediately had all her attention. "Tell me truly, will any man be able to stamp out the shrikes? Is it not too difficult a mission, even for a man like Tanos?" The bandits that terrorized the Upper Kingdom called themselves the shrikes, after those fierce birds. Our Nile shrike is smaller than a dove, a handsome little creature with a white crest and throat and a black back and cap. It plunders the nests of other birds and makes a grisly display of the pathetic carcasses of its victims by hanging them on the thorns of the acacia tree. Its vernacular name is the butcher bird. In the beginning, the bandits had used it as a cryptic name to conceal their identity and to hide their existence, but since they had grown so strong and fearless, they had adopted it openly and often used the black and white feather of the butcher bird as their emblem. In the beginning, they would leave the feather on the doorway of a home they had robbed or on the corpse of one of their victims. But in those days, so bold and so organized had they become that at times they might send a feather to an intended victim as a warning. In most cases, that was all that was necessary to make the victim pay over a half of all he owned in the world. That was preferable to having all of it pillaged, and having his wives and daughters carried off and raped, and he and his sons thrown into the burning ruins of their home to boot. "Do you think it possible that even with the power of the Hawk Seal, Tanos will be able to carry out the king's mission?" my mistress repeated. "I have heard that all the bands of the shrikes in the whole of the Upper Kingdom are controlled by one man, someone that they call Achseth, the brother of Seth. Is that true, Taita?" I thought for a moment before I answered. I could not yet tell her all I knew of the shrikes, for if I did so, then I would be forced to reveal how such knowledge had come into my possession. At this stage, that would not be much to her advantage, nor to my credit. There might be a time for these disclosures later. "I have also heard that rumour," I agreed cautiously.
It seems to me that if Thanos were to find and crush this one man, Achseth, then the Shrikes would crumble away. But Thanos will need help that only I can give him.
She looked at me shrewdly. How can you help him? She demanded. And what do you know about this business?
She is quick and hard to deceive. She sensed at once that I was hiding something from her.
I had to retreat swiftly and to play on her love of Thanos and her trust in me. For Thanos' sake, ask me no more now. Only give me your permission to do what I can to help him complete the task that Pharaoh has set him.
Yes, of course. We must do all in our power. Tell me how I can help.
I will stay with you at the court on Elephantine Island for 90 days, but then you must give me leave to go to him.
No, no, she interrupted me. If you can be of help to Thanos, you must go immediately.
90 days, I repeated stubbornly. That was the period of grace that I had won for her. Although I was torn between these two dear children of mine, my first duty was to my mistress. I knew that I could not leave her alone at the court without a friend or a mentor. I also knew that I had to be with her when the king finally sent for her in the night.
I cannot leave you yet, but don't worry. I have left a message for Thanos with Kratos. They will be expecting me, and I have explained to Kratos all that has to be done before I arrive back at Karnak.
I would not tell her more, and there can be few as obtuse or as evasive as I can be when I set myself to it. The flotilla sailed only during the day. Neither the navigational skills of Admiral Nembet nor the comfort of the king and his court would stand up to a night passage. So every evening we moored, and a forest of hundreds of tents sprang up on the river bank. Always the royal stewards chose the most congenial spot to pitch camp, usually in a grove of palm trees or in the lee of a sheltering hillock, with a temple or a village nearby from which we were able to draw supplies. The entire court was still in festive mood. Every camp was treated as a picnic. There was dancing and feasting in the light of the bonfires, while in the shadows the courtiers intrigued and flirted. Many an alliance, both political and carnal, was struck during those balmy nights, perfumed with the fruity aromas of the irrigated lands along the river and the spicier desert airs blown in from further afield. I used every moment to the best advantage of both my mistress and myself. Of course, she was now one of the royal ladies, but there were already several hundred of those, and she was still a very junior wife. Lord Intef's foresight might change her future status, but only if she bore Pharaoh a son. In the meantime, it was up to me. Almost every evening after we had gone ashore, Pharaoh sent for me, ostensibly to see to the cure of his ringworm, but in reality to review the preparations for begetting a male heir to the double crown. While he watched with interest, I prepared my tonic for potency and virility from grated rhinoceros horn and mandrake root, which I mixed with warm goat's milk and honey. When he had taken this, I examined the royal member, and was delighted for the sake of my mistress to find that it possessed neither the length nor the girth that one would have expected from a god. I was of the opinion that my mistress, even in her virgin state, would be able to cope with its modest dimensions without too much discomfort. Naturally, I would do all in my power to avoid the dread moment, but if I was unable to stave it off, then I was determined to ease the passage to womanhood for her. Having found the king to be healthy, if unremarkable, in these regions, I recommended a poultice of corn flour mixed with olive oil and honey to be applied to the royal member at night before retiring, and then I went on to deal with the ringworm. To the king's intense gratification, my ointment cured the condition within the 3 days that I had promised, and my already considerable reputation as a physician was enhanced. The king boasted of my accomplishment to his council of ministers, and within days I was in huge demand throughout the court. Then, when it was known that I was not only a healer but also an astrologer, whom even the king consulted, my popularity became boundless. Every evening there came to our tents a succession of messengers bearing expensive gifts for my mistress from this lady or that lord, and begging that she allow me to visit them for a consultation. We acceded to only those with whom we wished to make better acquaintance. Once I was in the tent of a powerful and noble lord, he with his kilt up around his waist while I examined his hemorrhoids. It was a simple matter to extol my mistress and bring her many virtues to the attention of my patient. The other ladies of the harem soon discovered that my Lady Lostries and I sang a beautiful duet together,
and that we could compose the most intriguing riddles and tell even more amusing stories. We were in demand throughout the court, and especially amongst the children of the harem. This gave me special pleasure, for if there's anything I love more than animals, it's small children. Pharaoh, who was responsible for our popularity in the first place, soon had the increase of it reported to him. This further spurred his interest in my mistress, if it were not already sufficiently intense. At sailing time, on many mornings, she was summoned on board the royal barge to spend the day in the king's company, while most evenings, at the royal invitation, my mistress dined at the king's board, and regaled him and the assembled company with her natural wit and childlike grace. Of course I was always in discreet attendance. When the king made no move to send for her in the night, in order to force her to submit to those horrible but rather hazy terrors she had conjured up, her feelings towards him began to moderate. Beneath his glum exterior, Pharaoh Mimosa was a kind and decent man. My Lady Lostris soon realized this, and like me, she began to grow quite fond of him. Before we reached Elephantine Island, she was treating him like a favourite uncle, and quite unaffectedly would sit on his knee and tell him a story, or would play throwing sticks with him on the deck of the royal barge, both of them flushed with the exertion and laughing like children. Aiton confided to me that he had never seen the king so gay. All this was watched and noted by the court, who very soon recognised her as the king's favourite. Soon there were other visitors to our tents in the evening, those who had a petition which they wished my mistress to bring to Pharaoh's notice. The gifts they proffered were even more valuable than those offered for my services. My mistress had rejected her father's gift in favour of a single slave, so she had begun the journey southwards as a pauper, dependent on my own modest savings. However, before the voyage was done, she had accumulated not only a comfortable fortune, but also a long list of favours owed by her new rich and powerful friends. I kept a careful accounting of all these assets. I am not so conceited that I should pretend that my Lady Lostris would not have achieved this recognition without my help. Her beauty and her cleverness and her sweet, warm nature must have made her a favourite in any circumstances. I only suggest that I was able to make it happen a little sooner and a little more certainly. Our success brought with it some drawbacks. As always, there was jealousy from those who felt themselves displaced in Pharaoh's favour, and there was also the matter of Pharaoh's mounting carnal interest in my mistress. This was aggravated by the period of abstinence that I had enforced upon him. One evening, in his tent, after I had administered his rhinoceros horn, he confided in me, "Daita, this cure of yours is really most efficacious. I have not felt so virile since I was a young man, way back before my coronation and my divinity. This morning, when I awoke, I had a stiffening of the member, which was so gratifying that I sent for Aiton to view it. He was mightily impressed, and he wished forthwith to fetch your mistress." I was thoroughly alarmed by this news, and I put on my sternest expression, and shook my head and sucked air through my teeth and tut-tutted to show my disapproval. "I am grateful for your good sense in not agreeing to Aiton's suggestion, Your Majesty. It could so easily have undone all our efforts. If you want a son, then you must follow my regime meticulously." This brought home to me the swift passage of time, and how soon the 90 days of grace would be up. I began to condition my mistress for that night, which Pharaoh would soon insist upon. First I must prepare her mind, and I set about this by pointing out to her that it was inevitable, and that if she wished to outlive the king and eventually go to Tanos, then she would have to submit to the king's will. She was always a sensible girl. "Then you will have to explain exactly what it is he expects of me, Taita," she sighed. I was not the best guide in this area. My personal experience had been ephemeral, but I was able to outline the fundamentals and to make it seem so commonplace as not to alarm her unduly. "Will it hurt?" she wanted to know, and I had hastened to reassure her. "The king is a kind man. He has much experience of young girls. I am sure he will be gentle with you. I will prepare an ointment for you that will make things much easier. I will apply it every night before you retire. It will open the gateway. Think to yourself that one day Tanis will pass through those same portals, and that you are doing this to welcome him and no other." I tried to remain the aloof physician and take no central pleasure in what I had to do to help her. The gods forgive me, but I failed in my resolution. She was so perfect in her womanly parts as to overshadow the most lovely blossom that I had ever raised in my garden. No desert rose ever bore petals so exquisite. When I smoothed the ointment upon them, they raised their own sweet dew, more oleaginous and silky to the touch than any unguent that I could concoct. Her cheeks turned rosy, and her voice was husky as she murmured, "Up until now I thought that part of me was meant for only one purpose. Why is it that when you do that I long so unbearably for Tunnus?" She trusted me so implicitly, and had so little understanding of these unfamiliar sensations, that it required the exercise of all my ethics as a physician to proceed with the treatment only as long as was necessary. However, I slept only fitfully that night, haunted by dreams of the impossible.